Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And this morning, what we're going to be doing is a little drinking.
Well, we're going to be talking about drinking anyway.
Yes.
Whether we'll actually get around to any drinking, I'm not sure.
And our first guest is one of our favorite people to talk wine with. It's Alice Firing. And she always has some unusual take on it. And just wait till you hear the region of the world she's talking winemaking about now.
Joseph Stalin is responsible for a lot of things, many of them not very good, during his time in office and before that in leading parts of the Communist Party in Russia. But he was from a part of Russia that was reluctantly part of Russia called Georgia. And there's something else going on in Georgia that is going to be the subject of our conversation with Alice Fearing.
Firing.
And we should say Alice totally fireless. I wondered if it rhyming with fearless. Because she wrote a whole book about the making of wine in Georgia. And it's called For the Love of Wine, and it's a page-turner. You can't put it down. But it began a long time ago, like 8 centuries BCE or something like
that. That's hard to believe. I was amazed.
And Stalin almost succeeded in destroying it in a period of like 2 decades. Mm. How come?
Well, actually, it was really post-Stalin that the real devastation happened. It wasn't actually that bad. But anyway, it started with the five-year plans. So each five-year plan, which was an agricultural program meant to increase productivity in fruits and vegetables and grain. So each five-year plan pushed the productivity from the last one. By the time, and this is certainly post-Stalin, it came in the 60s and 70s and the 80s, especially the 70s and 80s, the five-year plan was so extreme that it was virtually impossible to meet the demands for wine. Absolutely impossible. And so where wine really was disgraced was that it became extremely common for commercial wine to have all sorts of additives in order to just increase the bulk.
Right.
So much so that there became a black market for homemade wine. So in some ways, it was devastating for commercial wine, but in other ways, it really made people even more interested in making their own wine and doing anything they possibly can, because Georgians love to drink, and they really need wine, and so you...
And what about that brandy?
But it was really very undrinkable. There was one film that I talked about in the book, Ota Yoseleni's Falling Leaves, that was about this very thing. It was actually, for some reason, it wasn't totally banned, or at least it wasn't banned for a while. And it was absolutely true. I met several winemakers who worked in the factory that Yoseleni based his film on, and they said everything was true. The wine was totally undrinkable, and there was just a tremendous amount of additives.
Now, the remarkable thing, in fact, is that these home winemakers, you say, are responsible for the fact that there is a Georgian wine business at all, because if they had not persevered in their own backyards, then the whole wine stock might have been lost.
Yeah, but going back to Stalin, Stalin was from Gori, about center Georgia, and he loved wine. He really loved wine, and in the book I have this wonderful experience with his last living winemaker. He made wine for Stalin the last 2 years of Stalin's life, and it was a fascinating, fascinating talk with him about what it was to make wine during that time, how scary it was, what it was, what would have happened if Stalin didn't like the wine, how much Stalin drank. It was an amazing link to the past.
But let's go back to the beginning, because there are two things going on I think, and just to simplify it for people who won't have the patience to read the book all the way through, there are two things that sort of intersected. One were the grapes themselves, varieties which are unique to Georgia, and
exactly.
then the other intersection was the method of actually making the wines,
mm-hmm.
with this word that I can't pronounce, but which
Gravna
called amphora.
Yeah.
And how is it pronounced?
Quivery.
Quivery.
It's in the book it's spelled Q-V-E-V-R-I.
Yeah.
But just think of it as K-W-E-R-V-R-I. Then you get Quivery.
Quivery. Okay.
What
is a Quivery?
Yeah, right. That's a good question. I was going to ask that very question because I'm sure.
Yeah, it's an excellent question. Let's start with the vessel, then I'll get to the grapes. It very well may have been after grapes fermented on the vine themselves, it must have been the very first vessel, that container in which to ferment. So it is it differs from other amphora because it has a very, very specific shape. It is citron-shaped with a little point at the end, actually not so little, and so it's this bulbous thing with a point at the end that has to be buried in the ground for stability. The Greeks and the Romans really didn't bury theirs. They had it fermenting above ground. They had these stands for it. But in Georgia, it is planted, and it can stay there forever unless there's an earthquake. It is built in one piece. Fired in one piece, it is often lined with beeswax or propolis as an antiseptic and a sealant, and outside it gets a wash of lime paint as to strengthen it. Now, what the other method that the Georgians have used for centuries is, so they use a log, they hollow out a log, and they either foot stomp, they actually do foot stomp, and the log, the juice runs into the quivery, and
that's it.
That's about the biggest piece of intervention that they do. Because after that point, the white wines are made like red wines. So they stay in the container. It's sealed up after fermentation. It stays on its skins and its seeds until usually about 6 months. So when the wine comes out, it is a very deep amber colored, and so it was the original orange wine. Red wine is done a little bit different.
Hold on a second. Just in case I forget, because we the last time we were in Friuli, we had some orange wine.
Yes.
And so the same practice is taking place there. Is it the same reason they have the wines they call Jaune, the yellow wines in the in the mountains in France?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same. Oh no,
Jaune is different. Jaune is a totally different thing.
Okay.
Do you want me to go into it with Jaune?
No. If it's not the same thing,
but it's made a little. It's made more like sherry.
Okay.
And Jaune actually, it's not really an orange color at all.
Okay, got it. But the Friulian one, it really.
But that one definitely is, and it is.
Similar idea.
Yeah. The whole movement from Friuli started back in the late 80s when, I think it was late, no, it was the late 80s, I think it was the early 90s, when Jessica Grobner from Friuli went to Georgia and saw these big vessels and was captivated with the idea of making wine with them and brought them back home with him. And he experimented until he decided that this is his future, and he was making his wine in that totally.
Got it. So the other people who are making the same kind of wine are following his lead, I guess you'd say.
Right, exactly. And Jesco was very, very important to the whole Georgian story because he really, the Georgians were just going home, making their home wine, not even really bottling that wine for quite a long time after the fall of the Soviet Union. But Jesco really brought this kind of wine to the wine-drinking world before the Georgians did.
Well, it's amazing to see this. I mean, we actually saw the Grobner from I mean, he dug up his whole wine room, dug it up and planted it. They're humongous. How did he even move them?
How did he move them?
You need a lot of friends. That's what happens in Georgia. I guess you open up some wine and you get all of a sudden you have a lot of friends.
Yes, and it's and the Georgians do love drinking with friends.
Yeah. Now, another thing that I thought was interesting, and I didn't follow every step of this detail, but there are some places in Georgia where the soil, if you like, the dirt, is superior for making the quivery.
Yes, the clay.
Yeah, in fact, I was just there this week, Imereti. And if you go into the vineyards during the rain, you will see exactly why it's a great place for clay. And it's just, the clay there is unbelievable. It has such stick-to-itiveness, you can't get rid of it. And that is, as you're driving from the east to the west at the main highway, and highways, by the way, are not Georgia's strong suit, but you go through every village and you hit the Potter Village, which actually there's some, and it's just like a stretch of all these artisans and their pottery wares. You know, and there's ceramics of all sorts. And then there you meet them. You come to Zalago, who is probably the most famous of Georgian quivery makers right now.
But they actually build them. You explained that they make sort of ribbons of clay.
Yes.
And they lay one ribbon on top of another, on top of another, on top of another. Because the pots are so big, there's no way you would put them on a potter's wheel or anything like that.
Oh, yeah.
But then they fire them for how long? I think you said about 24 hours?
No, I think I said about 2 weeks.
Two weeks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're huge.
Yeah, huge.
And this is at like 900 degrees Fahrenheit or something like that? That's a hell of a fire.
I think that's what I said, is a hell of a fire. And these things are walled up, and then the wall is broken down.
Uh-huh.
You know, when they take the quivery out, and it takes quite a bit for something that size to cool down as well.
So you've got the quivery, and then you've got varieties of grapes which aren't known anywhere else. Sort of like the grapes in Portugal.
Mm.
Right?
Yes.
So there's a family of Georgian grapes.
But when you think about there are more than 525 grapes in for different kind of varieties in such a tiny country.
Yeah, I was amazed when you said that.
And when you said that Stalin and the Soviets basically, almost destroyed Georgian wine, what they did do is they simplified all those 525 grapes into maybe the top two or four. So where Georgia is really known now for two grapes, two grapes, Saporavi and Riccazzatelli. And what's happening right now is this tremendous revival of lost grapes that is very inspiring because there's such a variety. But those were the two most productive grapes, so those are the ones that everybody planted.
Well, now, did you get to taste any of these, the old grapes that are being revived?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Probably the rarest was something called Red Horse Breast.
Horse Breast?
Horse Breast, and I did get to have the wine that was made from a 400-year-old vine that people go and visit as if it were the oracle. It's really quite remarkable.
Oh,
it's
wow.
Still extremely productive. And others that people don't really know about are Chef Capito and Tetri and Tavquiri is coming back, Odileschi. There's not exactly household names, but some of these really give birth to remarkably tasting wines.
But none of it is really traded internationally, am I right there?
No, a little bit. Odileschi, not. There's not enough of it. Horse breast, not. Though I think we're getting, in the United States, actually, the guy that makes wine from this 400-year-old vine, yes, that's coming. What we have here is Silicoi, Siska, Tavquiri, Kisi, Chinoy. We're getting quite a few of the lesser-known varieties.
But they're coming in like suitcase full quantities.
Well, they're actually coming in bottles. There's every year since I started going there, the winemakers and people making wine have, I know they're just like on fire. When I first went in 2011, there were about five or six of the natural winemakers who were working this way, and now there are about 65.
Now you've had quite a lot to do with this. Now don't be modest here.
Tell us, I may have had something to do with it.
Tell us a little bit about what you were up against and what you were able to succeed in doing, just yourself.
Well, when I went there, I was very concerned. You know, there is a lot of commercial wineries out there, and they'll do fine on their own. But I was really concerned of the small independent winemaker who wanted to work naturally. And these are eccentric wines. If you're used to natural wines, you'll probably love them. If you're not used to natural wines, you might be a little bit hesitant to taste a wine that looks brown when it's a white wine. but there were a lot of consultants coming in at a lot of the time at the government's behest, and they were trying to push their product and trying to get these winemakers to modernize, to clean up anything that could be a perceived flaw in their wine that many of us happen to like. So I wanted then to give these people enough attention or anything that I could give them in my power so they would find their market, so they would be financially viable, so they wouldn't be tempted to think that there was something wrong with their wine and they had to change. So that was my goal.
Now, you reached the point, though, of confidence, of the people in Georgia having confidence that they, having just sort of shown up before, they started inviting you to come and really encourage them some more. Don't be bashful now.
I'll try not to be. I might have had something to do with it, but really, Georgia has been getting so much press in the past 5 years. And what I have been somewhat responsible for was the introduction of Georgia to France, and that ended up to be a very, very big deal.
And that's mostly the vessels, right?
Yes, but by establishing relationship with winemaker Thierry Pouzelot in Loire, I brought John and A Peasant's Tears and his winemaker Gala to a big, big natural wine fair, the Deep Boutte. On the way, I stopped off at Thierry Pouzelot, knowing Thierry, also being a fine winemaker, also imports wine. And he immediately wanted to import them. Mm-hmm. What happened after that was a cultural exchange between so many French winemakers and Spanish winemakers and the Georgians. So there's this, you can now go to France and Italy and Spain and drink Georgian wine, and you find winemakers going to Georgia as a pilgrimage, learning how to work with Cuvée, and it's a tremendous cross-cultural experience now. And so that I was responsible for, and so as a result, there is a award-winning documentary on Georgian wines that was made in France, and that has done a lot to help raise the awareness. Yeah, it's the wines that fancy restaurants like Noma. Yeah. Okay, I had something to do with it.
Yeah, there you go. Not only that, but you brought back some recipes, too.
Yeah, that was my first book with recipes.
Well, this one right here, for Love of the Wine, has some recipes in it.
The whole, Georgia is much more than wine. It is impossible to drink without feasting. Feasting is so much a part, and a super is a feast. And the food is so much a part of the wine experience, I felt it would be impossible to do this book without including recipes. Yeah.
Well, we know you just got back from Georgia, and you're jet-lagged once again. So let us let you get on jet lag. Thank you so much for sharing this information with us, and for creating this beautiful book, which is a really wonderful story for those people who like to see the good guys win eventually.
Yeah. So again, it's Alice Firing. The book is called For the Love of Wine, and she's you're a charming writer on top of everything else, Alice Firing.
Thank you so much, Anne. It's really nice talking to you both again.
Yes. Yeah, cheers. Have a glass pretty soon.
I will. Just a couple of hours away.
It's interesting that on the menu I actually heard about this wine production technique before.
Yeah, but not from in this place. Actually.
Well, this is where Jakob Gravner. This is where Gravner he gets his amphora from
Georgia.
So,
right.
So he sought them out, and apparently a number of other winemakers are doing the same thing.
It's a startling look. Yeah. I mean, it's startling to look at these big vats.
Well, especially as they are the only ones that you can actually see, because they're not buried in the floor of the cantina, is the broken ones. anyway. A very interesting story. Alice, we don't know where you'll pop up next, but we're sure it'll be interesting, and we'll have you back on the program. And we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. If any of you out there are considering becoming a sommelier, I think you better listen up to our next guest, who is, I would say, three quarters of the way through the total process.
Exactly three quarters of the way through. And I think he'll make it the rest of the way. But it's more than just a story about one man becoming a sommelier, because it's a story also of an amazing place where you can stay and enjoy America the Beautiful. Thanks to a major American businessman, it turns out. So not only are we going to hear about how you become a sommelier, we're also going to hear a little bit about
Triple Creek Ranch
in Montana.
Yes, well, here we have somebody who knows, how would you say it, the wine from both sides of the kitchen. How would we say this? Jeremy White, you started out with culinary training, and you now have mastered the art of wine. You've earned your sommelier certificate. What interested you? You said you're from Virginia, but you were living in the Willamette Valley, or you were living in Portland, Oregon, and became familiar with the wines of the Willamette. And so you decided to know more about it. Is that how you usually do things?
Yeah, just by stroke of luck, I was working in a nice restaurant in Portland, and
which one?
It was called Wildwood.
Okay,
oh, sure.
We know Wildwood.
We know it well. In fact, a name you're very familiar with, Evan Goldstein. Evan Goldstein and I met at Wildwood.
Oh, really?
Years and years ago. We subsequently interviewed him and we interviewed his mother several times.
Oh, yeah, I've known Joyce for years.
It was this interesting intersection. It was a very nice restaurant. Corey, somebody or other, was the owner and the chef, right?
Yes, Corey Schreiber was the founding chef, and then he kind of turned the reins over to Dustin Clark. Okay. At the time that I was there.
Well, I was there having dinner one evening, and there was this guy sitting at a sort of a counter, I think, and he was obviously getting a lot of attention. And I had no idea.
Yeah.
I had no idea why he was getting so much attention, but he was. But it was pouring down with rain. So, and Wildwood's pretty much out of the center of the town. So I said, why don't you, where are you staying? He said, I'm staying at the Heathman Hotel. Where obviously wouldn't you stay? I think I was staying at the Marriott across the street. I said, let me give you a ride. And by the time we got to his hotel, I found out that Anne and his mother were best friends.
Oh, wow.
And he's an enormous credit to American enology and knowledge about wines himself. So, you were in good hands at Wildwood, I guess.
It was a great place to be, yeah.
So
I was only there for a brief time, but...
And then, what did you do next?
After that, I came to Montana for the summer, and I worked at Triple Creek Ranch. It was an internship as part of graduating the culinary school. And they had a need for a person to... basically be a sommelier on the floor. And so after that first summer, I came back the following summer, and my position was basically wine steward. So I spent my days, you know, just serving wine to our guests.
Now let's make it sure people understand, because I don't think that Ann and Peter among them, most people who are into fine dining and fine lodging would not necessarily look to Montana for an elegant Relais Chateau property. So give us the 2-minute spiel on why Triple Creek is so great and why it's in Montana.
Okay. So our current owners, Barbara and Craig Barrett, used to come out to this place, Triple Creek Ranch. They were guests, you know, and they were just trying to, they were looking, you know, they'd come out on vacation, and it's out gorgeous, gorgeous natural beauty in the Bitterroot Mountains. It's southwestern Montana. And I guess as the story goes, 1 year the property was up for sale. This was about 1993 or 94. And they loved coming there so much that they ended up purchasing the property.
Now, Craig Barrett was a businessman, right?
Yes, he worked at Intel.
It's the same. I wondered if it was the same Craig Barrett, and indeed
yes,
it is. So he was the guy who publicized that the rule that the microcomputer chips would increase in speed every 2 years forever and ever and ever and ever and ever.
Yeah, that's actually called Moore's Law.
Moore's Law, yeah, right.
Yeah, it refers to Gordon Moore, you know, and Craig worked with Mr. Moore for several years, yes.
He didn't just exactly work with him. He was kind of like the boss, right?
he became the boss, yes.
so he had enough money to buy a little ranch in Montana.
Yeah, you know, and it was very small at the time. And they kind of grew the resort over the years. And Barbara, you know, petitioned Relais and Chateau and said, hey, you know, we'd like this to be a Relais and Chateau property. And, you know, Relais and Chateau will come out and inspect your property and make sure it's
you have to have five C's, right?
Yeah, that was... They changed that a couple years ago, but the core values are still the same. And the beauty of Relais and Chateau is that it's about the uniqueness or the charm, which is one of the five C's,
right,
of the property. And that's what makes Triple Creek so special is, you know, its location, the way that the Barretts present the property to the guests. You know, I've been to a couple of Relais and Chateaus where you have to wear a suit and tie, and it's, you know, it's not necessarily stuffy, but it's very elegant. Triple Creek, you know, is a lot more casual.
Well, Montana is,
Anyhow. Yeah, people going to Montana don't ship a whole lot of ties, I don't think. But let's switch now, because we've now established that one rich man can make a lot of things happen if he feels like it, which is, sounds like a really great idea. You schooled yourself on wine starting in Oregon in the valleys there of the Willamette and the other rivers around there. It's a big transition from tasting wines which we enjoy, which we think are great wines, but the rest of the world doesn't necessarily agree, to passing the sommelier exam. That's really advanced. I mean, how did you manage to advance your knowledge so much and so quickly?
Well, it took several years. you know, I tell a lot of people, it's become an obsession. This kind of obsession to gain knowledge, to learn about the different wines of the world. You know, there's a lot of wines that I don't like. I wouldn't go to a restaurant and order, but on the other hand, there are people that do like those wines, so I need to know what they taste like, where they're from, why they are that way, so I can present those wines to the people that do like them.
Well, let's come back to that. First of all, let's talk about what's involved in. You've passed the third level, and there are four altogether.
Yeah, and this is the Court of Master Sommeliers.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Sounds pretty good, but this one level is still to come, right?
That is correct. The Master Sommelier Diploma is the kind of the jewel in the crown, and it's a very difficult exam.
Yeah, that's the one everybody complains about, right?
yeah, they complain until they pass it, I guess.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden they're on the inside laughing at all the people on the outside.
Yeah.
So what did you have to do for this third level, first of all, and then just quickly, what's ahead of you? I know you're going to try. I'm sure you didn't get to three to not try four.
Oh yeah, for sure. Definitely going for the fourth one. The exam itself is a three-part exam. You have a theory exam, which is just kind of they're asking you pretty detailed, complex questions about wine making, the different grapes that are grown in different regions, stuff like that. There's a blind tasting exam where you have to blind taste, and basically what you're trying to do is what the court calls deductive tasting. You're taking all these clues from this wine, the color, the smell, the taste, how much tannin is in the wine, and you're trying to accurately come to a conclusion about what that wine is, what the grape is, where it's grown, was it a hot vintage, a cooler vintage. And then there's a service exam where you go into a room, and it's just like being in a restaurant. You know, you have master sommeliers at different tables, and, you know, those are your guests. And so you're there taking care of your guests, and they're asking you questions to see how proficient your knowledge is.
Now, to the next level, what do you have to do? I mean, that sounds pretty tough right there. But what's involved in the next step?
So it's the same. It's a similar exam format, except there's a couple differences. Obviously, the questions are more difficult. The theory exam at the advanced level is on paper, okay? The theory level at the master's exam is oral.
Uh-huh.
So not you have to be able to take what they're asking you and speak back, you know, and you're talking about several different languages that you have to be able to comprehend and speak back correctly to the masters.
Okay, so it's not just done in English.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, you think of all the French wines. You know, France is such an important part of the wine world. To be able to pronounce the regions correctly, the vineyards of Burgundy, you know, that's a challenge in itself.
Okay, so you don't have to give your entire answer in French or German or Italian.
No, yeah.
But you have to be able to pronounce the names of the wines properly.
Correct, yes.
Well, you know, I mean, so much, we belong to a blind wine tasting club, and it was amazing what people could tell from a sip of wine. I mean, it was just absolutely amazing. I mean, they could tell you, they could pinpoint within inches of where the wine came from, you know. But a lot of it is memory, because I know I do it with food.
There was another thing too. There was one guy there who was a good friend and a little bit stuffy about his wines. He had a considerable amount of family wealth, and he had labels made for his wines saying from the cellar of. We won't put his name out on
Thank
the
you.
Air. but he believed in the principle that a quick look at the cork will tell you a whole lot more about the wine. He would always be, everybody would arrive with their wine in a brown bag, and our friend would be there, and he would volunteer to open the wine, and he would pretend like he was keeping it inside the bottle as he took the cork out. but somehow there was a little sneaky look there that gave him just a little bit of a clue as to what he might be looking at.
But what I was aiming for, and what I was starting to say, is that so much of it has to do with memory. And, like, I can remember flavors. It's wine memory. So that means that, essentially, you've got to have drunk a lot of wine, right?
I taste a lot of wine, yeah. There's a big difference between drinking and tasting. Yeah, a lot of it.
You don't spit backwards, which we interviewed. Was it Alice? No, it wasn't Alice Firing. Who was it?
It was somebody who wrote. She was interviewing a winemaker in the Alsace region of France, and she noticed at the end of a long tasting session that her spit cup was full, but his was still empty.
Yes, yeah.
So she asked him, and the quote is in the book: he had been spitting backwards. Here's a funny story for you, because one of the wines that we took to the wine tasting group, and we were known for having a lot of renegade wines, but
okay.
I presented a wine on one occasion which was a
I don't know what you're talking about.
A Viognier. It was a Viognier from Elk Cove Vineyard in Oregon.
Oh, nice.
And our favorite, yeah.
They said, we don't know what it is. We think it must be Chondria. But we don't know where it came from. So I won that one with a big fat smile on my face. I think they only made like 5 cases, of which I bought 2.
Yeah. Well, let's get to another issue here. Is I like the food world, the wine world, the beverage world of dining has expanded dramatically, not only geographically, but also in the kinds of beverages you drink. And I was wondering, does the sommelier training and certification process still limit itself to wine, or do you expand into things like, we've had sake paired with seafood at Le Bernardin. We just did a beer dinner, which I wasn't all that thrilled about because it was mainly sour beers, and I don't like sour beers. Yeah, I only said that was a no-brainer. I wasn't going to like that. And other things like you're getting the stuff out of South America that's not wine, but it is a legitimate category for a beverage list. Do they teach you anything about that?
Yes. You have to know spirits and beer and coffee and tea. It is truly in the pursuit of knowledge of beverages as a whole, and not just or sparkling wine.
This is for the sommelier exam or just for the job of being a sommelier?
For the exam.
Okay, all right.
Mostly. And I think anybody who is a sommelier or a beverage director, they have to know and be able to speak fluently about the different types of beverages of the world.
Yeah, the one who paired sake with, I think it was scallops, was Aldo Sohn. You know him?
Yes. I've met Aldo once, yeah.
Yeah, he's a wonderful guy.
He's a fabulous guy, but the most amazing, the most interesting thing he told us was he won the world's best sommelier award, and they won't let him enter it again.
It's a one-time shot.
That seems kind of unfair. But listen, before we go, we're taking a lot of your time.
We're having fun talking to you, have you noticed?
And you mentioned that there are some wines that you know, you feel you must know them, but you don't especially care for them yourself. Well, we won't ask you which wines those are. that seems unkind. But 2 questions. Which are the wines which are, first of all, among your very favorites? And then the second question, right on the heels of that, is are there any new areas of the world that are offering particularly fine economics, good bargains for the interested but not impecunious wine buyer like ourselves?
Okay. So part one, I personally love Pinot Noir and Riesling.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are they can be so different. There's especially Riesling. There's such a wide range a huge spectrum of Rieslings. They can be bone dry with high alcohol. They can be very sweet with low alcohol, and anything in between. You take a Riesling from Oregon, fabulous. You take a Riesling from Alsace and Germany and Australia, and they're all completely different. But you know that it's Riesling. So I'm just fascinated with why. Why are they like that? Why are they so different but so much the same?
Right.
You don't have an answer, though.
Huh?
You don't have an answer to why, huh?
Well, I'm trying to figure that out.
Well, I think a lot of that's terroir.
You remember
when we were at Yulumba? And that lady, she was, we were talking about terroir, and we were going out to dinner with her later on, and she just stood up, Jane Ferrari, I think her name was, she didn't make cars, she was a wine ambassador for Yulumba. She said, "We're off." So we got in her truck, she only drove a truck, and she had a whole lot of glasses and a whole lot of bottles of wine in the truck, and she drove us to the top of the hill. And then she poured one Riesling, and she said, "That's from over there."
Yeah.
And then she poured another one. She said, "That's from over there in a different direction." She said, "Now you know about terroir."
Isn't it? It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's such a cool thing.
And then now, any bargains out there? Anything out there that people haven't discovered yet that won't put you in the poorhouse when you order it?
Some of it's discovered, but I think, there's excellent bargains from Spain.
We like Spain.
Seeing a lot of wines come in from Sicily and Corsica.
Yeah, that's a change.
There you go.
Sicily, I mean, I remember when the stuff was undrinkable.
Yeah.
And now it's good, yeah.
You know, modern winemaking has been, coming into some of these regions, and the stuff they're putting out is fantastic. I would keep an eye out for British Columbia in Canada, especially the Okanagan Valley.
Huh.
Amazing stuff up there that it isn't really getting imported into the United States, but hopefully it will be one day, but great wines. I'm still really interested in places like Virginia and the Finger Lakes in New York, where are they going to be?
Well, we were at the inn at Little Washington. He served us. We did a whole tasting menu with Virginia wines.
We spent a week or 10 days just before Virginia Wine Month.
Did that too.
So the Commonwealth of Virginia actually sponsored us, and we went all over the state. Sampling wine, and Barbersville was one of our particular favorites.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was one that was owned by the lead singer of the something, not the Charlie Daniels band, but another similar band, who had bought a winery in Virginia in the same way as Craig Barrett bought the Relais Chateau property in Montana. So it's been so much fun to have you part of the show today. I don't know when we'll find ourselves in a Montana direction, but we'll try one of these days.
We'd have to make it a specific destination.
We would.
Yeah, come by and say hi. Thank you so much for this opportunity. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Well, it's fun. I had a good time talking to you.
You be sure to call us back when you become the total master.
I will.
And we'll document what you had to learn between now and then.
Okay.
Jeremy, have a great day.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Bye, Jeremy.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Did you know that it's possible to compile more than 250 different craft spirits available in the United States and now part of a book? Did you know that?
No.
Well, of course you really did. You really did know that.
I thought you wanted me but to
it,
sit down.
It actually sort of gives you an idea of what sommeliers are up against.
Well, he was. Are you talking about our next guest yet?
Yeah, we're talking about our next guest who actually took upon the task of documenting the huge number of spirits like cognac and bourbon and Scotch whiskey and all that kind of stuff that are actually being made in craft distilleries across the country and around the world. And he decided to compile it all into a book. And my guess is that he thought that he was fitting himself out for a lifetime pursuit, because by 5 years from now there'll be another 250, yes, and he'll have to issue volume number 2. But in the meantime, we have
Eric Grossman, who's a very busy man.
Grossman is a fine last name here in Western Pennsylvania. Eric Grossman is our guest today, and he's not from here, and he doesn't even know that during the era when the Pittsburgh Steelers first were winning Super Bowls, this was the era before tight ends were elephants, Steelers had a rather small tight end called Randy Grossman, who contributed considerably to the first two winning Super Bowls in the Steel City. You've been here recently, Eric, and you like it here, and you're planning on coming back soon. We'll be glad to welcome you, but that's not what we're talking about today. What we're talking about today is
craft spirits.
It's an encyclopedic volume.
It is.
And I think the first question I have is, what did you leave out?
Not much. After a bit of debate, trying to mince words in terms of what's a spirit and what is distilled, we really tried to focus on distilled spirits, which eliminates the likes of sake, beer and wine, of course. And we're in this new world where so many spirits, in terms of marketing, branding, labeling, cross over into other boundaries or are angled to the market to maybe take up the share or interest from other areas. So it is an interesting time, that's for sure.
And well, just the idea of the word craft spirits. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know what a craft spirit is nowadays. I used to think that it was like going smaller, getting rid of the big companies and doing small artisanal things. But now all the big companies are absorbing the small artisanal companies. Yeah. And where are we now?
That's an excellent question. That might be the $1 million or I suppose $1 billion question. We see the likes of McDonald's and every big company you could think of now appropriating and hijacking that term, if you will. So it's complicated. There are certain checks and balances in place which a certain segment of the consumer pays attention to in terms of American Craft Spirits Institute or different groups that say, okay, if you produce more than 50,000 cases, then you cannot be considered a craft spirit. Or very commonly, if not all elements or all major elements of the production process are not performed on site, then certain people will not view you as a craft spirit. But certainly it is a broad overreaching term.
Well, you said if the owner was anonymous, you wouldn't include them.
It just depends. Obviously it's a sensitive topic for many producers and owners. There's a lot of companies that now have corporate ownership or partial corporate ownership, and they don't really want that fact disclosed. So putting this book together and trying to verify all the info was an extra large mountain to climb, primarily because it seems that it is in the primary interest, vested interest of so many of these companies to keep a lot of their information, processes, volume, all these different sort of important core metrics hidden from the public.
Now let's talk a little bit about what people are going to find between the covers of this book, because it's a variety of different things. First and foremost, for those people who don't know, because they never thought they needed to, or they just never had the opportunity, you actually explain the distillation process, which is not all that complicated, but it is different.
Yes.
And rather than dwell on it here, if this is something people are interested in, and they should be, then they should just get a copy of the book and study all the diagrams and all the information you've included there.
I agree.
You categorize things into several different spirit categories. Go ahead and explain what those are.
So, yes, I am looking at the table of contents here, which is helpful for a book of this nature, because as you have mentioned, it does pretty much go A to Z in terms of what is included. And obviously, when you think of a contemporary bar in America or around the world, you have your core spirits that you tend to find right up top, the vodkas, the gins, the whiskeys, the rums. So those certainly are given front-facing coverage here, where there is a pretty, you know, detailed explanation of what these products are, how they're made, maybe how they were produced historically versus how they're produced today. And then a lot of examples of the craft spirits within these categories, which I think is perhaps the most exciting aspect of this book overall, because I'm thrilled that the book has been released around the world. A lot of people have responded positively to it, and especially I think in those markets, to generalize, where people haven't had much exposure to small production gin or naturally flavored vodka that's made from whey, for example. Just different kinds of different styles and different kinds of spirits that truly are foreign or unknown to, I think, the majority of readers, unless you're a real insider industry person, an expert bartender, you know, a distiller yourself. There's no way you're going to be familiar with all of the products that are featured in the encyclopedia section of the book.
Now, it's interesting to take a historical perspective, and you do that at various places in your book, but it's sort of intriguing. If you think about it, the mother of all the spirits is probably gin.
Mm-hmm.
And gin arrived in the United Kingdom, where it became most famous. Mm-hmm. At least those of us who believe London dry gin is the best tend to think that.
He does, of course.
But interestingly enough, it got its original prominence because it was called Dutch Courage, and while the British Navy gave its sailors a tot of rum every day, in the case of the foot soldiers, it was gin.
Yeah.
And it was gin purveyed by Prince William of Orange when he came over to be co-monarch with his wife William, coming over from, and not too long after that, the name changed and it became known as Mother's Ruin. because the beverage got so popular and,
well, that's Hogarth.
And it was also not very good.
No.
So as a result, mothers in particular made themselves very ill by consuming vast quantities of this, but there were gin mills just everywhere in 17th century London, were there not?
No, it's amazing. The pictures, as I mentioned earlier, the numbers are staggering. It's obviously a different time now, and society would frown upon really any segment of its constituents, you know, consuming liquor of that quality and also of those quantities. So it is amazing to think back to that time and to look today. And for example, there's a Dutch Courage gin in the book, and a lot of these newer, younger producers are honoring history and really doing their research, getting stuck in, and trying their best to recreate or elevate or replicate a lot of these historical-minded spirits, which do, of course, have now centuries of history with amazing stories and anecdotes and whatnot. So I do feel that's one of the more exciting aspects of the time we're in right now, where you do have an opportunity to taste a spirit pretty much as it was, you know, several hundred years ago. Several rums are being produced in this historical manner as well, and historic pot stills and whatnot in these small tropical islands in the Caribbean. The Agricole rum is having a moment right now, you could say. So it is exciting for consumers to, and obviously without a huge investment as well, just to order a dram or a glass or a cocktail in a bar, it's not going to, in general, cost you too much unless you're in your New Yorks and Londons these days. So you can have that sort of cultural experience that goes beyond just having a drink.
It's interesting. They say the Scotsman never really has a good glass of whiskey because they always put too much water in it.
It's amazing. Yeah, another overarching theme of the book is that there's people like myself and certainly many experts who will tell you how to consume something, tell you what something is in this world, but so much of it is subject to interpretation and subject to one's personal preferences and whims. So I've certainly met with enough distillers, producers, bartenders, people in this world who ultimately are reluctant to tell the consumer what to do, how to think, what to drink. And that's something that's quite nice. It is open and accessible, and if a certain spirit or a certain cocktail isn't for you, there's nothing wrong with that. And one of the areas of the book that also is exciting is this concept of manipulating spirits in terms of infusions or through cocktails.
Yeah, you were doing that, and I was wondering when you have so much material, why you got into infusions. Is that something a lot of people really love?
As I understand it, it is. It's kind of it's a sensitive topic in that so many of the spirits in this book, the top quality spirits, you never would want to infuse. If anything, it would be disrespectful to the producers and the history and the origin to stick a cinnamon stick in a fine bottle of whiskey, for example. But we are seeing this time now where people feel empowered to do what they want once the product is in their home and at their home bar, let's say, to whether it's through a cocktail more commonly, but through an infusion to make something a little more palatable, festive, celebratory. And certainly one of the basic disclaimers that we note in the book is, okay, you're not going to use a $100 fine bottle of spirits for an infusion, or you really shouldn't. But there are obviously much lower cost, affordable alternatives, which are still of a good quality, especially when you get into that sort of neutral area with vodka in particular, that lend themselves nicely to infusions. And then, of course, for every person who wants a gentle, natural infusion of, fresh herbs from their own garden or cardamom or an interesting spice, there might be someone else who wants to stick a chocolate bar or a piece of bubble gum in their vodka to see what happens. And that might not be for me or you, but,
I've been amazed to see people send us samples all the time. Especially, we have all these varieties of vodka that we keep getting. I mean, we've had it made from quinoa. We've had it made from deep ocean seawater, which I never did understand. We have a cucumber vodka, which started out tasting all right, but that got pretty tired fast.
That's coming from the home of all spirits, Austin, Texas, of all places.
Oh, yes.
Wow.
Then right up against that is a bottle of vodka, and I think it came from the Ukraine, but I'm not absolutely sure.
But they all start with different things.
It's sort of hard to keep track. And then you have this quinoa, vodka, which is a crossover. It's an interesting crossover because the quinoa is grown in Ecuador. It's made into beer in Ecuador, we understand, and then transported to the Cognac region of France.
Yeah, that was odd.
To be distilled into vodka. So there's a sort of a crossover there. I did note with interest that you had a number of cognacs in there, but the really expensive ones you didn't have. Now, most people, I guess, would agree that the volume of cognac being produced by Remy Martin and Courvoisier and all those people probably practically qualifies them as craft, because they are relatively small in their output.
But it's a big production.
But perhaps you left them out just because they're too expensive.
That certainly is part of the thinking. It's cognac of all the categories within the book is probably the most complicated to put your finger on because through the nature of the incredible rules and regulations that the producers must follow quite strictly, it basically has made it, of all these categories, of all these spirits, the one that has been toughest for newer, younger producers to break into. So if anything, we tried to focus on, okay, some older producers who are firmly established but still have quite the small production scale and really have a keen attention to detail or a compelling story. So, there really was no one, basic metric in terms of trying to determine who made it into the book. Because the book has this international distribution, it was important to have an international or global balance within the categories. Of course, with cognac being only produced and bottled in France, that kind of tied our hands. But I think especially looking over into the brandy side of things, we tried to mix it up a bit and bring in different producers from around the world to show people the different kind of fruits and the different expressions of the spirit one can find. Cognac is a little more limited, but certainly as I've learned more about the spirit and try the spirit, it's been interesting to see the different ways that it can be manipulated with the aging and the barreling and all the different techniques.
Yeah, of course,
that are
that's happening with everything. I mean, this barrel aging. We've had barrel aged Negronis, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, and you have to be you have to be careful with that. The people who made that said you have to be really careful because with a small barrel. A small content, it's easy for the wood to dominate, but I wanted to take us in a slightly different direction because, and here we're up against the definition to a certain extent, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't lose sight of the truth, and that is that single batch, small batch, not necessarily single barrel bourbon, has made a recovery in the bourbon category in brown spirits when everyone was forecasting that the, American whiskey business would be out of business, and these producers, in many cases, they're not craft producers within the meaning of the size of their output, but they are craft in terms of the quality that they're extracting, and in single expressions, like I just had a Woodford Reserve, super expensive but super carefully produced bourbon. And the same thing is happening with products of the Jim Beam Company and Belmead Bourbon coming back in Tennessee. I guess I called it Belmead Bourbon, but it's really Belmead Tennessee Whiskey, making a comeback with the grandsons of the original founder who went out of business during Prohibition. So here you've got a slightly different characteristic, but one that is kind of important for the spirits drinker to embrace, I think.
I completely agree. Another tough category, or perhaps the toughest overall category to put your finger on, is whiskey and bourbon, rye as well. I think of any category among mainstream spirits, it is the category that elicits the most confusion. Really on both sides, I find, and I definitely attribute a lot of that to the producers and the companies themselves. I understand why the larger companies that own a lot of these smaller historical brands don't really want the public to know or understand the scope or scale of how the spirits are produced. With that said, there is such a compelling history, and especially as an American myself, something I respond to in terms of, you know, this whole concept going back to Prohibition, but especially in more recent times, this amazing talent and technique and foresight centered in that Kentucky, Tennessee region. But now really you see all over the country a lot of innovation and a lot of producers who have sort of planted their flag and changed the way people around the world view different spirits. And there's something inspiring about that. And also to your point, I think that I completely agree, and it's important for consumers to remind themselves, hopefully through their own discovery and trial and error, that smaller production, smaller batch does not always full stop equal better.
Oh, yeah.
Right, it's just different.
Just different, exactly.
Yeah, I think that's important. But it is important to know people, that the number of people are out there. And before we came on the air, I said the biggest problem you've created for yourself, Eric, is how you going to keep this up to date. And now we tested it pretty carefully. We sample rather widely through the spirits categories of all kinds. Mm-hmm. So we did a program just a few months ago on British gins, and we noted London Dry Gin, and we noticed that Sipsmith's and Langley's Number 8, both which were our favorites among the ones that we tasted, that they are in the book. We found Cold River vodka in the book. We didn't Interestingly enough, yeah, we didn't find Cold River gin in the book, which we also enjoyed.
Gin, yeah. Too.
That was a distillery that we went to in Freeport, Maine, which is famous for only one other thing, which is the L.L. Bean. And the people who were there told us that. They said people are not exactly beating a pathway to our door, but we are trying.
Yes. It is funny to see these spirits. As I mentioned earlier, so many people in the States, for example, won't be familiar with these top British gins, and then vice versa. People in the U.K. even don't have the access to the top American bourbon. So it's kind of never-ending in a sharing of information and knowledge, and hopefully that's what the book will help with. To your point, we tried to strike a balance, too, between newer products that really have only come to market, let's say, in the last 5 years versus firmly established sort of flag bearers for the industry in terms of craft spirits and small batch spirits, micro distilleries, whatever terms you want to use. And several of those now have 10, 20 years of history under their belt. So we tried to find a balance because obviously in print these days, it's always a delicate concern where you want to make sure what you're putting into publication, into circulation, will be around in a few years. And obviously it's quite a competitive time in this industry. So when we do have a new producer from Finland or Germany in here who only has really started up operations in the last couple of years, that is a concern. But obviously that's what revisions and new editions are for, and through the strength of the Penguin Random House family and the Burling Kindersley DK imprint, it's expected and hoped that we'll be able to put a new edition out in the next year or two, in which, of course, if any of these spirits drop off the market, they'll be replaced, and I'm sure also in that time there will be some new companies that are starting up as we speak who will kind of earn their way into the book, so we'll see how things transpire.
Oh, I didn't realize. I didn't realize it was a DK book. I love their guidebooks. I think they're so thorough and they're so effective.
And that's part of my journey to writing this book, was that I've edited and worked on just about every North American DK eyewitness travel guidebook
at some point or another.
Over the past decade. So that was certainly one of my introductions into travel writing, which is still my overall bread and butter forte, you could say. But, you know, working on the guidebooks has been an amazing journey and experience and privilege for me, and they are wonderful and have such a focus on history and context. So it has been amazing in this new sort of digital world that I also work in, but also to kind of have one foot in this old-school print world where even now still it fills me with a lot of pride when I'm in New York City primarily, or any of these main touristic areas, and you see people holding these books that I've worked on that are translated into at least 20 languages. It really depends on the topic or
the
title.
Well, good for you.
Yeah, it's been an amazing journey.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You sound like you have a lot of fun, but you're probably not sober very much.
I think the first DK guides we got were the first time we went to Rome together. We bought Rome and Florence and Tuscany in bookshops in Rome, and we've lived with the guides ever since. We're so glad to put a face behind the name of the guidebooks, and you've done a great service here with this particular book. It's
called Craft Spirits. Know the makers, infuse your own, create new cocktails, and that's just the beginning of what you're going to learn about spirits in this book by Eric Grossman. Run out and you'll refer to it constantly because it's the ultimate reference book on spirits.
And I sense a sequel in the meantime, Eric. It's probably the sun's over the yard arm somewhere where you are, so I think you've earned a little sip.
Might be time for a little bit of research.
Yes,
right?
So enjoy, and thank you so much for your contribution to today's On the Menu program.
Thank you, Ann and Peter. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Eric.
What is there to say after a program like that? Do we say cheers, or do we say bottoms up? What do we say? We say we'll see you again, same time, same place next week, and until then,
bye-bye.